move on to the third case of the morning, the Mark Taylor versus Billy J. Michael. Ms. Shippey?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Meredith Shippey from Foley & Lardner, and I'm here as court-appointed counsel for appellant Mark F. Taylor. Your Honors, this is a case about a man who's been fighting for a fair trial for 11 years. 11 years ago, Mr. Taylor's constitutional rights to effective counsel were violated at the hands of his own trial attorney, whose representation fell far below acceptable standards due to this attorney's distraction with this attorney's own indictment for felony bribery during the course of Mr. Taylor's trial. For 11 years, Mr. Taylor has worked tirelessly to try to right those wrongs. He's pursued every avenue he could to have the litany of errors during his trial recognized, addressed, and righted. And his last effort, his petition for habeas corpus, was dismissed as untimely by the District Court for the Central District of Illinois, which, as you know, is why we're here today. Now, this court should equitably toll the one-year statute of limitations under the Antiterrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 to find Mr. Taylor's habeas corpus petition timely filed. Now, as the court knows, under the AEDPA, a petitioner has 1 year plus the 90 days during which to file a petition for certiorari to file a habeas petition from the point his conviction in this case was confirmed by the Illinois Supreme Court. This is effectively 455 days. Now, under Section 2244D2, this period is told while a properly filed post-conviction appeal is pending. Now here, the clock started running again on February 22, 2005. This was 90 days after the denial of Mr. Taylor's petition for leave to appeal on direct appeal in front of the Illinois Supreme Court. And the clock was told for 54 days until Mr. Taylor filed his post-conviction petition on April 18, 2006. Now the post-conviction proceedings remained pending until May 28, 2009. At that point, Mr. Taylor had 311 days remaining to file his habeas petition. This would have made it due on April 4, 2010. And Mr. Taylor filed his petition 4 months after that on August 17, 2010.
What did he do in the meantime there? Was it just he couldn't find an attorney or didn't know what to do or what?
That's exactly the issue here. When his petition for leave to appeal was denied by the Illinois Supreme Court, he was informed by his then-attorney, one of many in a long line of attorneys, that he had 1 year plus 90 days to file a petition. In the meantime, during that period of time, he was also under the impression, due to certain letters that were sent back and forth between his mother and him, his mother had been very involved in finding representation. His family had hired the America's Criminal Defense Group, which was an online law group based in California, and they had appointed attorneys that had seen him through, that might be overstating it. One of the attorneys had seen him through the last of his post-conviction stage at state court, in the state court level.
Did they actually show up? Were they present, or is this all long distance?
One attorney was an Illinois attorney. The attorney prior to that was actually a Nebraska attorney, and she has since had her law license suspended by the Nebraska bar for neglecting client matters. This happened during the same time that he had requested her to file a petition for rehearing before the Illinois Appellate Court at the post-conviction stage. He had also requested that she file a petition for leave to appeal before the Illinois Supreme Court. She did eventually file the petition for rehearing, but never filed the petition for leave to appeal. Mr. Taylor wrote to her. His post-trial attorney actually wrote to her, and she never responded. He did file a complaint against her with the Nebraska bar, and again, the bar did find, not based on his complaint, but other clients' complaints, that she had been neglecting all her client matters and actually suspended her law license.
Ms. Shippey, I understand that the appellate court denied rehearing with regard to the post-conviction appeal on May 30th, 08, and that from that time on, Mr. Taylor had 35 days to file a timely petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and then 249 days passes after the 35 days elapses.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is the period of time during which this Nebraska attorney, Paula Hutchinson, was supposedly, or the ACDG, which is based in California, and there were case managers based in California, the main source of contact was Anthony Partipolo, I believe his name is, and he was the one communicating with Mr. Taylor and with Mr. Taylor's family. He had told them that this Nebraska attorney, Paula Hutchinson, had been appointed, and that was the period of time during which these problems occurred.
But my point is that you're asking the court to also toll that time in between, that is the 249 days in between the elapse of the timely filing of a petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court, and then finally in later on in May when the petition for leave to appeal was to file in stanto was actually granted.
Your Honor, yes. That's one of two arguments we have for that period of time. We do believe there are grounds to equitably toll that time, purely based on the fact that Attorney Paula Hutchinson just disappeared for all intents and purposes. And Mr. Taylor had tried, as she was under direction from the ACDG, to file the petition for leave to appeal before the Illinois Supreme Court and never did so. And they did eventually assign a new attorney, and that was Ross Eagle, who did file the petition for leave to appeal in Stanter, which was the 249-day period afterwards.
Counsel, how many lawyers has the petitioner had in that case?
Well,
post-trial.
Post-trial?
Yeah.
I believe, including myself, there would be five at this point. If you include the attorney he also hired at the district court level.
Did two of those, I guess, didn't he?
I'm sorry?
At the district court level, weren't there two?
He originally filed his habeas petition pro se, and then he did hire an attorney who filed an amended habeas petition on his behalf. And then we came in at the, we were appointed by the Seventh Circuit, obviously.
And these are retained counsel?
Aside from us, Your Honor, yes, these have all been retained counsel.
Aside from Paul and Barb.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, aside from you.
Yes, these have all been retained counsel.
Mm-hmm. His mother was doing most of that, I suppose. Is that right?
It sounds like his family has been,
people
has been very involved in helping him.
Money? Somebody, I saw a pretty big
yes.
money that somebody spent.
From what I've seen, they spent about, it's been close to $100,000 to various.
They've had a lot of paid attorneys that didn't do their job, it looks like.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct. And getting to that point, as we said, there are many reasons to equitably toll this time. A lot of it deals with, especially the period of time during which he should have filed his habeas petition, but didn't, the 7.5 months after the Illinois Supreme Court denied his final petition for leave to appeal, that we are asking to be equitably told. During this period of time, there was communication between the America's Criminal Defense Group, his mother, and Mr. Taylor, who is incarcerated and is essentially left to rely on letters, to rely on communication via letter. That he really was under the impression that they were still working on his defense or something was going on. And there was a lot of confusion, and it wasn't simply a matter of a late filing, or it wasn't just a miscalculation of time on the part of his attorney. There was more than that. Like, he definitely was convinced that the America's Criminal Defense Group not only should still be working on his behalf, but had been told by his mother that they were.
Well, up until January, right? Mm-hmm. Up until January 10, I think, where he received confirmation that the ACDG, for lack of a better word, that they would not be pursuing the federal appeal on his behalf. To establish equitable tolling, you have to prove two things, right? Extraordinary circumstances.
That's correct.
And you have to prove diligence.
That's correct.
And so after January 10, once he found out that he didn't have a lawyer, Why did it take him till August 17th to actually file a petition?
He had been told that the deadline was 1 year plus 90 days. He calculated the deadline on his own and determined that... He determined that the deadline was approximately 14 days after he did file, I believe. August 27, 2010 was the date that he believed the habeas petition was due. And this was based on his statutory right to have a one-year period of time to research, file, figure out how to write his pro se petition for habeas. And that was, it's not a question of whether he filed it on the first day of the limitations period or whether he filed it on the last day of the limitations period. You know, the limitations period is the limitations period. And to him, he had a year, and he was allowed to use that entire year.
And his understanding of that was based upon the statements by his prior counsel, right?
That's true. He's relied on counsel throughout this entire case.
And so I guess my question is, you know, given the fact, and we're talking about 8 months here, approximately 8 months, when he presumably was looking for a lawyer, but when he couldn't find a lawyer, I guess I'm wondering, why didn't he just file a pro se petition just to make sure that his rights would be preserved, and then he can continue to try to find a lawyer? Why did he wait so long?
He did, Your Honor, as I believe it's laid out in detail in his pro se application for a certificate of appealability before this court. He actually, at a certain point, did write a letter to Molly Armour, who was the attorney that represented him at the district court level, asking her to file something to extend the deadline, because he thought the deadline that he thought it was fast approaching. So he did go out of his way to try to pursue his rights during the time frame that he thought he was operating under. Given the number of attorneys he's gone through and the amount of communication with these attorneys, whether they return his communication or not, he certainly has not sat on his rights. He has appealed at every stage. To the extent there were late filings, to the extent there were mistakes made, these have been at the hands of counsel. These have not been due to Mr. Taylor sitting on his rights in any way.
You take it all the way back to the beginning, you know, it's a tough case, and then it's a question of whether he should have, you know, the original attorney should have cross-examined the minors and done more pre-trial stuff. It's a hard case.
Yes, Your Honor. And that,
and some lawyers probably looked at that and said, no thanks. And that may have been also why it's hard to find somebody.
We believe that's another reason that this case... The time should be equitably told in this case because of the gravity of the constitutional wrongs, because of all the errors made at his trial that have not been addressed fully, because of the fact that his lawyer was completely distracted by his own indictment for felony bribery during the course of his trial. And failing to cross-examine the minor witnesses with their prior inconsistent statements was just one of a long list of errors at the trial level. I see I'm cutting into my rebuttal time.
Ms. Kashyap?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Gopi Kashyap on behalf of Respondent. Respondent has proven that Petitioner's habeas petition is untimely under...
Speak up a little bit now.
Sorry, Your Honor.
I'll move the mic.
Don't want to lose track of what you're saying.
So. Sure, Your Honor. Respondent has met his burden of proving that Petitioner filed his habeas petition well after the statute of limitations expired under 28 U.S.C. sections 2244D1A and 2244D1D. Now it is Petitioner's burden to prove that he's entitled to equitable tolling for the various time periods he requests, but Petitioner has not met his burden. In this case, whether the petition was timely filed turns on three critical periods of time. First, it's the 249 days that Your Honor mentioned between the due date for petitioner's post-conviction PLA, which was May 28, 2008, and the date he filed his motion for leave to file PLA in stanter in the Illinois Supreme Court on February 3, 2009. The second critical period are the 90 days following the denial of his post-conviction PLA, which occurred on May 28, 2009, in which he could have filed a certiorari petition in the United States Supreme Court, but did not do so. And the third relevant period are the 7.5 months that petitioner allegedly believed the ACDG was working on his federal case. Now, the time, there's two different inquiries here, and that's the under 2244 D1A and 2244 D1D. And to find the petition timely under the former D1A, this court would need to toll the entire 249-day period plus either the 90-day period and the 7.5-month period, or the 7.5-month period.
Your voice is fading out a little bit. I want you
I'm
to
still, I'm sorry.
Well, these are recorded, too, and Judge Caney's long distance, so we want to make sure.
Sure,
that
I will keep my voice up. I apologize. And to find, so that under D1A, to find the petition timely, those are the, you would have to toll the 249 days as well as either of the other two periods. To find the petition timely under D1D, the court would need, to, not the petition, but at least his due process claim timely, under D1D, the court would need to toll either the 90 days or the 7.5 months. So I'm going to start with the 249 days. In his reply brief, petitioner requests that the 249-day period be statutorily tolled under D2 as well as equitably tolled. His statutory tolling argument fails because Griffith v. Rednor, this court held that these 249 days are not tolled because no properly filed application for post-conviction relief is pending in the state courts during that time period. Petitioner relies on Gonzales v. Taylor as purportedly overruling Griffith. However, Gonzales was interpreting Section D1A, which deals with the finality of convictions, not D2, which concerns whether in post-conviction proceedings a properly filed application for post-conviction relief is pending. And these 249 days concern the latter. And so Gonzales is not on point, and Griffith controls. As to the equitable tolling argument, again, Griffith is dispositive on this issue. First, the equitable tolling argument as to the 249 days relies on Paula Hutchinson's alleged abandonment of petitioner. Petitioner did not make this argument in his opening brief. He did not make this equitable tolling argument in the district court, so it is forfeited. But even putting the forfeiture aside, Griffith v. Rednor states that although a belated state filing may justify the state court to accept it and for whatever reasons the petitioner has alleged, that doesn't automatically justify tolling and justify the late filing of a federal petition. And that's because petitioner could have exercised due diligence during this time period. Petitioner knew the due date for his PLA, and he's presumed to have known it. When Hutchinson did not file it, he was bound to inquire as to what was going on, and he did ultimately do so. But the problem is that petitioner, the evidence in this case and the record in this case provides nothing regarding communications between Hutchinson and petitioner or his mother following the denial of the state appellate court's denial of petitioner's petition for rehearing, which occurred on April 24th, 2008.
How involved was his mother? I mean, obviously he's got somebody's paying a lot of money in addition to intervening on his behalf. And this is only a practical question. Were anybody on in the government side talking to the mother?
There is no evidence in the record of that, Your Honor.
I wonder who she's talking to, frankly.
The only evidence we have in the record regarding her communications are the three letters that petitioner submitted for the first time in his motion for a certificate of appealability to this court. So there's no other discussion of that.
Along these same lines, could you remind us again the age of the petitioner at this time?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear your question.
The age of the petitioner at this time?
How old is he?
How old is he at this time? I think he's almost 50, Your Honor. I would say I think he was about 42 at the time of the crimes. I'm guessing here. I don't know off the top of my head how old he was.
And but so we're talking about dealing with his mother, who's, I assume, in her 70s then.
Probably, Your Honor. I'm not sure how old she was when she had him. But even so, his mother was attempting, it appears, to find him counsel. But the problem is it's on petitioner to do his own diligence.
Well, it's not unusual that a family member tries to do these things. And it's pretty bad luck of the draw, if you want to call it that, but he picking these losers. But nevertheless, that seems to be what happened. But there was still a lot of time.
There was a lot of time, Your Honor. And then these 249 days, even if this court were to be inclined to equitably toll any of that period, it could not be for the entire 249 days, because the record shows on page 41 of the supplemental appendix, and this is what petitioner states, that Ross Eagle, the attorney who came after Hutchinson, was assigned to his case on July 28th, 2008, a mere 59 days after the due date for the post-conviction PLA. And so petitioner was not without counsel for the entire 249-day period. So if this court were inclined to give him some tolling for that, it would be only for 59 days. And adding those approximately 2 months to the remaining 7.5 months, the petition would still be untimely under 2244D1A, because petitioner would still have filed his petition at least 3 months late. So under no scenario is the petition timely under 2244D1A. So turning then to 2244D1D and the due process claim, and putting aside all of the forfeitures, we'll start with the 90-day period in which petitioner could have filed a certiorari petition in the United States Supreme Court following his May 28, 2009 denial of his post-conviction PLA. Even assuming that Eagle, which he did not necessarily misinform petitioner, but even assuming Eagle miscalculated the limitations period, it is well established that miscalculation is not a grounds for equitable tolling, and that is because it's a garden variety claim of negligence and not extraordinary. Lawrence v. Florida establishes that. Holland states it again, and Maple states it again. And so this miscalculation and petitioner's assumption that he was entitled to these 90 days is simply not an extraordinary circumstance, and nor was petitioner diligent, because even if he had been misinformed, he could have easily found this court's case law, Gutierrez versus Skomig, I believe, from back in 2000, that expressly states that this 90-day period is not tolled under the law. So then let's turn finally to the 7.5 months in which petitioner allegedly believed that ACDG was pursuing a federal habeas petition. This case is, petitioner relies on Holland v. Florida, and let's just emphasize, equitable tolling is an extraordinary remedy, and this circuit has never applied it in this context. So let's start with that. Second, in Holland v. Florida and Maples v. Thomas, the circumstances were egregious in that counsel had been appointed in those cases and then actually abandoned the attorneys. And let's talk about why this case is not Holland. Here, petitioner readily admits that he had communications with ACDG. In Holland, counsel didn't even talk to Holland during, even though Holland inquired multiple times and kept writing him letters, counsel didn't respond. In this case, it appears that ACDG was actually investigating and determining whether to do something. And while they may have chosen not to ultimately, and maybe that itself was negligent, that's not egregious. But putting aside the question of whether they were extraordinary circumstances, petitioner certainly was not diligent. As Your Honor pointed out, petitioner had the last alleged extraordinary circumstance ended on January 15, 2010. Petitioner under D1D still had approximately 4 months left to file a timely habeas petition. Yet he waited 8 months. So he waited for the clock to expire and then waited another 4 months. That cannot be diligence, especially given
that. When you phrase that he waited, do we know that he waited or was just a mistake?
There's nothing in the record that suggests that he did anything after January 15th, 2010 with respect to pursuing his federal rights.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So, Your Honors, that That's unlike in Holland, where in Holland, once Holland discovered that the clock had ran out, he filed the day after his federal habeas petition. He acted with diligence. The petitioner here was just not didn't even exercise minimal effort. There's nothing to indicate that he pursued his due process claim at all, especially in the state courts. He didn't personally repeatedly contact ACDG to ascertain the status of his appeal. And that's the point. The fact that he had these 4 months left on the clock, even after the last alleged extraordinary circumstance ended, it shows that the extraordinary circumstance did not prevent a timely filing, which it must. The case law is clear on that point. If you've got time left on the clock, the petitioner must file the petition. And it cannot be that the extraordinary circumstance prevented him from doing so. And as this case shows, I mean, petitioner himself stated in his pro se petition that the reason for his late filing was that he simply miscalculated the limitations period. He unreasonably relied on Eagle's purported advice that said he had 1 year plus 90 days, and then he miscalculated it. He did not toll the 249 days. He did not count the 249 days as being untold. He did not count the 90 days as being untold. And so it ends up being that the actual cause of his late filing was simply his own lack of diligence, his own negligence in calculating. And that it's well established under a long line of precedents that those are not grounds for equitable tolling in this case.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. We'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay. Thanks very much. Shippey, got 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points on rebuttal. Counsel made several comparisons to Holland, and I'd like to point out that in Holland, the Supreme Court made clear that the exercise of the court's equitable powers are on a case-by-case basis, meaning that the facts don't have to be the same as Holland. The inquiry, the flexibility of the equitable procedure is that the court can meet new situations and examine each case on a case-by-case basis, looking at those specific factual situations. So in order to equitably toll the time in this case, it does not have to be the same situation as Holland. Counsel also made the point that this is not an egregious case. But I would remind the court of the real issue, the real constitutional issues here in the first place, and that are the egregious errors that were made at Mr. Taylor's trial, his initial trial, at the hands of his trial counsel. As I mentioned earlier, his trial counsel was under indictment for felony bribery. Trial counsel never disclosed this fact to Mr. Taylor, and Mr. Taylor later stated in post-trial affidavits that had he known, he never would have agreed to let this hired counsel, somebody he had paid to represent him, keep representing him. He would have found new counsel. But he didn't know, so he couldn't do anything about that. And this indictment tainted trial counsel's effectiveness. His ability to provide any sort of effective defense was inherently compromised by his own indictment. The day after the first day of Mr. Taylor's trial, his trial counsel had his own motion to dismiss in his own case. And he was so distracted that he neglected to address one of the most glaring issues, which were the conflicting witness statements by the minor witnesses, neglecting to point out that there was any issue with the fact that the first statement, they all said that nothing happened, and the second statement came back with a litany of detail. Your Honor, we request that this court equitably toll the limitations period under the AEDPA to find the petition for habeas corpus timely filed and remand to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shippey. And I understand that you were appointed counsel, and we really appreciate your good work on behalf of your client.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. Yes.